Good morning, Gamecock fans. Today's Monday, January 26th, the year of our Lord 2026. This is Coffee with JC Sherbert. Hope you're staying warm wherever you are in the country right now, especially down south, Palmetto State. Just talking to some people, listening to the late night Gamecock show last night. It appears that not as bad as maybe it could have been. And that's always a good thing. So, if hopefully you have power, hopefully you're able to listen to this. Hopefully everybody maintains power on our end because, as you know, we do these remotely from home studios, and when the power goes out, it kind of affects the show. Up where I'm at, it snowed quite a bit, but got a little warmer yesterday. Bitterly cold today. So anyway, kind of thankful there was no Bears game yesterday to just so I could stay at the house, right? Anyway, over the weekend in basketball, Gamecock men, gosh, had a 14-7 lead and then blinked, and then it was close, and then at the end of the first half, the Aggies of Texas A&M just, I think they set a record for three-pointers. And blew out the Gamecocks, had as much as a 32-point lead and won by 23. So that's another road blowout against a good team. All the good feelings from the Oklahoma win kind of circle the drain, and you got Florida coming up Wednesday. The women did get back up off the mat and blew Vanderbilt out. You know, Vanderbilt, they're having a banner year in athletics. Their women's team was fifth in the country and undefeated. But the Gamecocks took care of them 103-74 on ESPN. So they rebounded pretty well from a loss, needless to say, and took it to the Commodores yesterday at Colonial Life Arena. So good job by Dawn Staley's team. Today on the Chief Sports Network, obviously it's Monday. So that means we'll have Whittle on all things. John Whittle of thebigspur.com is in on the morning show. Also, South Carolina baseball associate head coach Monty Lee will join Jamie. That's always a great conversation to get Coach Lee on. Obviously knows a lot about the team, baseball. They've been trying to scrimmage, and so that's good. And baseball season will be right around the corner. We'll have our normal opening day special this year when the time comes. More details like that to follow. Then on the show, it's another Meatloaf Monday with myself and Mad Dog Phil Mullinax. That will follow the show around noon, same stream, and then the podcast version. Please go, and I've looked at our numbers for this one and the show and the morning show. Gosh, the numbers are just about the same as they were when we left thebigspur.com and the 24/7 sports platform. So thank you for doing a great job of getting after that, rating us on Apple Pods and all that good stuff. Certainly appreciate you doing that. Okay, so time to talk a little football this morning. Get the week off right, right? I was thinking about this over the weekend and, you know, looking back, and I go back to about 1986. I was 9 years old and with the Gamecocks. That was the first season I really kind of got into it and understood the game to the point where I could follow it and things like that. I guess a little bit of a late bloomer in that regard, but, always hoped the game. I was always a Gamecock fan. I had a George Rogers helmet lamp on my bedside and would talk smack about Clemson and all this other stuff. But, you know, 86 was really, you know, I started playing the next year for my elementary school team. That's when I really started my, gosh, it's 40 years now. That was 40 years ago this season. But coming up, it'll be 40 years, golly, since I was immersed in this world and have been immersed ever since. And obviously, I wouldn't trade it for anything. Being following the Gamecocks, doing what I do for a living is a blessing. And but it all started in '86, so that's how far back I go. So for some that go back a little further, if I'm missing an instance or something like that with this, you know, just let me know. Cut me some slack. I mean, because it's hard to go back when you're not following it and you can't remember and find, you know, I got a subscription to newspapers.com. It doesn't tell you much, but I suppose there may have been some other instances where this did not work out for South Carolina. But most of the time it has. And what I'm talking about is adding rocket fuel to the offense. That's a very broad, maybe cartoonish, creative way of saying, our offense is stuck in the mud. We need to do something a little different, and it needs to be a little more creative and a little more fast-paced and things like that. And there are several instances where this has happened. So, and that brings me to how is it relevant for next season? Obviously, you're getting rid of what was, for just to be nice, a limited type of scheme, a very conservative scheme. It looked like, and I don't really, digging into it, it looked like what they were trying to do is be a power running team, an NFL style power run team, and that just didn't work with the line they had. And I got something kind of cool in the offensive line to wrap all this up, and it just didn't work. It just didn't work. You had a play caller that was stuck in the NFL 10 years ago. You had a quarterback that lost confidence. You had a line that was confused at best, just could not block at worst. Receivers were frustrated because they weren't getting many balls. I don't think they figured out who their best running back was. I mean, it was a disaster of epic proportions. And that's fine. We've all talked about that. There's no need to rub salt in that wound. But, the thing is, at the basic of the foundation of that struggle was it was the wrong plan. It was the wrong plan. And I will, I've apologized for getting behind it. But I've always been one that's like, don't run a quote unquote pro style offense at South Carolina. Even the big boys don't do that anymore. The NFL, and then the definition of that evolved because you have some NFL teams that, if you strip down what they do and applied it to college, you have to strip it down. And you can't have a bunch of complex stuff. But like the Chiefs, and I know they didn't make the playoffs this year. What they've done and been successful with, they took a lot of air raid stuff and gave it to Patrick Mahomes and just incorporated it into the NFL style. So it's kind of hard to just blanket say no on that. But if you actually try to do that, you're limiting it. And it's because college kids, no matter how many times people want to say they get paid and they're pros or whatever, are college kids. They're limited in the amount of time they can practice. You're revolving personnel year to year, even more than ever through the transfer portal. There's just not time to get immersed in it like there is in the National Football League. Plus, those are professionals. They don't have any other duties. Their job is to play football, right? And to learn football. And, and then again, from a competitive standpoint, you have to do stuff like that up there. So everybody's good, So those are all the reasons why I've always said that. And at South Carolina, to do something like that, you have to have overwhelmingly superior personnel. And I don't think anybody does in college football at all. People talk about Mike Bobo and, because he likes to run things out of the I formation. And, it's a pro style system. It's based on the old Mark Richt Florida State system. But you look at what Georgia does, and I know what they did under Todd Monken, and that was totally different. I know now Monken's in the NFL and all that, but in college it was different. And then, but you look at what Bobo actually does, and it's a college system, and it's a proven college system through the years. It may have pro principles, but it's college, okay? Because it's worked in college. So, but I've even thought, back in the day when LSU and Alabama. Les Miles, when they were basically 3 yards in a cloud of dust and stuff, I was like, well, they're winning with that because they're winning with defense, but you're not going to win in at South Carolina like that. I don't know that you can win anywhere like that now. I don't know of a single team that I look at and go, oh, yeah. I mean, if you do stuff like that, you have to be almost like Buster Faulkner at Georgia Tech and just have, you have some pro stuff like, multiple personnel groupings and things like that. But it's, you got a college quarterback out there in Haynes King that's busting his ass and, making things happen. So anyway, that's why I've always said that. And every time Carolina's tried to do something like that, power runs, it's not worked. It just has not worked. Maybe for a bit in 04, because Carolina had a good offensive line. They were deep at running back. D'Andrelle Pinkins, Savelle Newton, there's times here and there, Power, and when I'm talking power run, I'm talking like just want to run the ball up your butt and take your soul away. But very, very few times. In fact, it's all blown up in people's face multiple times. But we're not talking about the negative. We're talking about the positive. Like, what's the fix? And you know, I go back to 1985. South Carolina obviously was 10-4 or 10-2 in '84, best season in school history. '85 was kind of a struggle. 5-6. Offense wasn't all that good. They lost a bunch of players from what I read. And so we go to 1986, and Joe Morrison institutes the run and shoot offense. Now, that was sort of revolutionary back in the day. The run and shoot comes from Mouse Davis and June Jones, and you know, the Falcons ran it and Oilers ran it when Jerry Glanville and June Jones were there. And June Jones is kind of the guy that's known in the modern era for being a run and shoot guy. And it was kind of, I guess, was the pre, you know, I guess was the prelude to the air raid in some ways, and in some ways not. But Todd Ellis, the redshirt freshman quarterback that year, you know, South Carolina didn't necessarily win, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. They were 3-6-2 against one. They were ties back then. Against one of the toughest schedules in the country. They had Nebraska beat, they had Georgia beat. I mean, they had a lot of teams beat and just did not finish the deal. Tied Clemson, tied Virginia Tech on the road. But Todd Ellis threw for what was then a school record, 3,026 yards. Sterling Sharp had 1,000, I mean, 1,106 receiving yards that year. Offensive scoring went way up. Offensive stats went way up. And it was creative, aggressive, creative, and fun, right? And so that worked. Fast forward to 1993. South Carolina had high expectations, beat Georgia, lost a ton of close games. Carolina finished 4-7. The late, great Steve Tannehill was the quarterback then. And Sparky Woods got fired. Now, Sparky ran, I guess it was kind of a, I don't know, it didn't lack creativity. I mean, they could score sometimes. Art Wilkins, I think, was the coordinator. It was the same offense they ran at App State. It is a little pedestrian at times, and enter Brad Scott and Ricky Bussell, who he brought for 1 year for Virginia Tech in, and the quote unquote fast break offense, which Charlie Ward had run to perfection at Florida State in 93, and they won their first national championship. That's why Brad Scott was hired here, and things went up significantly. Carolina could score. Again, now they didn't score in all games. They're a little inconsistent that season, but scoring went up 8.1 points. Yardage per game went up 20.6. Gamecocks went from 4-6-1 to 7-5, won the first bowl game in school history. So that was one where not only the offensive stats went up and the offensive production went up, and a quarterback. Who I don't think I wouldn't say Tannehill struggled in 93, but his production in 94, and then especially in 95, which was a terrible defensive team, but an elite offensive team, those stats went way up. So there's another example. Now, Todd Ellis, of course, did not, he redshirted in 85. So you don't have a season where he, you know, maybe struggled and then kind of rebounded. But he, in his second year, in 87, that was one of the best teams the Gamecocks had had. They went 8-4, but they set some records and were pretty salty that season, 1987. So that was his second year in that system. So we go on and we go to 99. We've talked about 99 a lot because this past season was probably the worst offense since then, and a lot of injuries and all that. And that was a part of it, but the other part of it was Lou Holtz when he came in, getting back in the game. He wanted to do a lot of stuff like he did at Notre Dame when he left in '93. That's a lot of option and veer, and yeah, I don't even know if it would have fit the late great Phil Petty all that well, even if there hadn't been injuries. They did not have an offensive line. It was bad. It was just they Petty came back, and the Gamecocks put 21 on the board against Clemson. Lost 31-21 at home. I was at that game to cap off the 0-11, but and that was like a miracle to get that many points, 21 points. Imagine that. So, and the Gamecocks drove the ball that day too. That Pennock had a good game. I think there were some field, it wasn't just three touchdowns. There were some field goals in there and stuff where they just didn't kind of couldn't quite close the deal. But man, you know, that was a rough year. Well, 88 and a half yards per game and 15 point, wait a minute, hold on. Sorry. I'm sorry. I am reading. I'm trying to read this because I want to be accurate here. 140.4 yards per game and 15.7 points per game later in 2000. The Gamecocks had at the time the best turnaround in program history. So there's another winning example. They went 8-4, won the Outback Bowl. Wasn't exactly a high scoring team, but it was enough, right? And it was much better than the 7.9 points per game they averaged the year before. By the way, I just want to say this. These stats, once we got into the SEC era, they're in SEC football games. So I'm gonna talk about, you know, I wanted to clarify that the Ellis stats and stuff, obviously Carolina's independent. This is in SEC football games. So 15.7 more points per game in the SEC, 140.4 yards per game. And that year, Skip Holtz, who was kind of a guy that, you know, we talk about Dan Mullen and Urban Meyer's spread option. That was kind of Skip Holtz's baby. And so it went from a lot of power eye and like op veer principles and stuff to a spread option tempo. And I remember the quote. I don't remember what player it was from. It was in the state newspaper in 2000 and said, you look at defenses playing against our offense, they look like they want to throw up. And I remember the Georgia win, which was week two. 21-10, they ruined Quincy Carter's Heisman thing. I think he threw five picks that day. Obviously, the story of the game was the defense, but at the end, Derek Watson had a big run to put it on ice. Georgia was gassed because they just line up really fast and go. And so that made a huge difference and kind of set the stage for the two, I call them the Outback years. 2000, 2001, Gamecocks were 17-7 in the national conversation. So that's big for the program. And so if Lou hadn't done that, I don't know that that team would have scored and been as successful on offense. And again, they weren't a juggernaut. That was definitely a team where Charlie Strong's defense, which had great players, kind of set the pace. But the offense put a lot of pressure. The whole thing was designed, that whole team was designed in 2000 to put pressure on the opposition on both sides of the ball. It was beautiful. I mean, it was gorgeous. And, you know, it was a great year. One of the greatest years of Carolina football, just because of the 0-11 the year before, and then turning it around. There were some heartbreaking moments. Clemson game that year with the push off was very, very tough. Blowing a 21-3 lead at the Swamp when you could have won the SEC East, that was tough. Coach Spurrier started dialing them up in that game. That was kind of a rough one. They lost to a 3-8 Alabama team on the road. 27-17. I remember that one. And then they had the second most disappointing one probably wasn't the Florida game. It was the Tennessee game. Tennessee had rubbed it in Carolina's face for years after that win in 92. This was 2000, and Tennessee had blown the doors off Carolina. It was just a little closer at home. You know, sometimes they win by 9 to 17 points at Williams-Brice. And then in Rocky Top, they just blew the doors off of them. Well, this was at home. Carolina 14-7 lead. Tennessee went on this big drive where they just ran the ball and once ended up winning 17-14 on a very hot late October day at Williams-Brice. But so it wasn't without disappointment, but it was a good year. And, you know, like I said, the defense set the tone that season, but the offense, with what their plan was, got them to the point where they weren't a liability and they're actually kind of dangerous. Derek Watson, Andrew Pennock, all the Jermail Kelly, all those guys. So we move forward through the Spurrier years. And this isn't necessarily okay. So this is different because in all three of those other instances, Carolina went from a bit conservative and a bit more run focused and ball control focused to more wide open and aggressive, right? This not necessarily that, but I did want to point this out. Because what Spurrier did, Spurrier was aggressive, right? But what Spurrier did in 2009 to 2010, and look, I'm going to just admit, this may not be as applicable to the point I'm trying to make because Marcus Lattimore came in, and obviously that's a big difference. And in 09, Eric Wolford was, that was his first stop at Carolina. And in 09, with Garcia, Kenny Miles, they did run some zone read stuff. But what that was Spurrier until 08 ran his same old run game, which is a lot of draws, and heck, the draws were very effective, and that was fine and things like that. But he made the decision when he got Eric Wolford in, and then Sean Elliott came in the next year and installed even more of the App State run game, which is very successful up there. He just kind of turned that over to them, and they ran the fun and gun or whatever, cock and fire over the top Spurs offense. G.A. Mangus came in as well, and that's exactly what Mangus had done at Delaware Valley and Middle Tennessee's previous stop. So they tied it all together. And the 2010 team, which won the SEC East, is statistically one of the best offensives Carolina's had. They had a 3,000-yard passer, 1,000-yard rusher, 1,500-yard receiver. They went up from 09, 10.3 points per game and 45.4 yards per game in SEC play. That was a big tweak. It wasn't like the other ones when they were like, well, we're going to open it up and do, but it was different. And it was a great coach that had a proven system, tweaking his system for success and optimizing it for the school that he's working at. Because South Carolina, probably at the end of the day, it's hard to be like Florida was, which was more faster and more athletic than everybody else. And against the rest of the SEC and the defenses at the time, that time of the in the SEC, defenses were ferocious. Probably a little bit smarter to have more of a creative run game, and then it allowed Connor Shaw to be outstanding and Garcia and Dylan Thompson and all that. So that was a big change. We'll go to the Will Muschamp era. And yes, this happened. Now, this is one of those times that didn't lead to more wins. But Kurt Roper, and I remember, I don't, I, Kurt Roper, and he had a good year at NC State, not going to lie. But he's coaching a lot different than he did at South Carolina. I'll never forget when he came in, and I endorsed the Muschamp hire written wise, and I didn't think he was going to hire Roper. I thought he was going to make another decision, and so I was kind of behind it. But, and I'm not saying had I known that. I mean, you couldn't really tell much from his first year at Florida. He was there 1 year, Muschamp's last, and he had Treon Harris, a defensive back at quarterback half the year, and they were better. They didn't win enough, but and they had some awful offensive performances, including against a bad Gamecock defense, and the game against Missouri was a disaster. But then they had some good performances. I mean, it wasn't like I was against, but he said something before they coached a game that was interesting. He's like, I'd rather like point and shoot than just shoot. And, from what I was told during the time, he spent a lot of time, game day. And there've been a lot of guys like this around here, very good on the chalkboard. They sound like geniuses when they're sitting there talking about it and drawing it up. And in theory, it should always work. And that's why, Marcus Satterfield probably had the job because you look at what and everybody could see, even coaches said, they're calling when Satterfield was here. And we'll talk briefly about that in a second. He was like, well, they're running some good stuff. It's just execution and players look confused and all that. I don't think that was a problem with Roper. I think Roper, along with it was game day. And Satterfield had some issues with that too. Like just couldn't call it, couldn't fly the plane, as I like to say. Knew all about the plane, knew all about aviation, couldn't fly the plane. I think at NC State, he's flying the plane. But that offense in 2017 had a load of future NFL guys, a second year guy in Jake Bentley, who was promising. I know Debo got hurt, but that's no reason. And they did win 9 games, and they did what it took. And they won the Now, he wasn't there for the Alamo Bowl. So he won eight, right? But after the Clemson game, he got fired. Brian McClendon takes over. The Gamecocks have a great rally. They beat Harbaugh in Michigan in the Outback Bowl. Now, big picture wise, because I do believe Eli Drinkwitz would have been the coordinator hire had they not promoted Brian McClendon. That's my informed, very informed opinion. And you look back on it, like, golly, how things were, you know, I understand that it didn't work out at the end. But 2017 to 18, the offense did get better. And that was one of the best offenses. South Carolina really had some bad injury issues on defense. And everybody also continued, you know, sometimes it's your last game. And they got shut out by Virginia, you know, but they only had the ball for 17 minutes. Still, they got shut out and couldn't do much in the bowl, and that was embarrassing. But you know, Carolina improved in SEC play 5.9 points per game and 88.5 yards per game. And what BMAC did that year, he opened it up. It was a spread tempo, chunked it around, spread the field, a lot less thinking. RPOs were still a big part of it, but it was a little bit better. You know, in 18, as far as the plan went, it made more sense. And the calls were better. You know, and I'll give Brian McClendon a lot of credit for being a good play caller that year. I mean, 19, there are a lot of issues with that team. But 18, BMAC for a first-time play caller, I thought he dialed up good. And the stats will tell you that. You look back, that offense was actually really, really good with a lot of good players. So there's an example from the Muschamp era. You know, I mentioned Satterfield earlier. When they decided in 2022 for the two games left in his tenure to say, we're limiting all this. We're just going to be aggressive. We're going to let Spencer go play and take advantage of the players we have. Look what happened. 94 points against Clemson and Tennessee ruined their season. Memories of a lifetime for the Gamecock Nation. And it even carried over to the bowl, even though Satterfield was gone. You know, Carolina, gosh, injuries and opt-outs hurt them in that one. But, and they did have, well, I guess, I don't know if they were great on offense. The plan made sense on offense. First part of the game, they were dialing them up. And Nate Atkins getting hurt them in that one. It's hard to say that it was a great offensive explosion, though, because you had, you know what, a special teams touchdown. You had two defensive touchdowns. So that was 21 of the 38. Still, you know, I didn't have a problem with the offensive game plan. And they couldn't help it. Everybody got hurt and opt outs and stuff like that. Juice got hurt in that one. It was the coming out party of Xavier Leggett. But if you look at that small sliver of the Beamer era when they said, all right, we're going to go, you know, declutter this thing and get it going. It worked, didn't it? It worked. Carolina won. Carolina won. So that brings us to now. And so, concluding all that, because what they're doing is a lot like 85 to 86, 93 to 94, 99 to 2000. Not that similar to 09, 2010, but I wanted to throw that in. And then 17 to 18 is that they're becoming more aggressive on offense, aggressive, creative, and fun, with going from Mike Shula, Mike Furry to Kendall Briles. So that's what's happening here. And I'll just say Shula, because Furry, yeah, shoot, he did three games and things were somewhat better, and it was more aggressive, creative, and fun. But going from what happened last year, and really under Dowell Loggins as well, and you can see, you know, some of the pro stuff kind of creeping back in at App State a little bit with Dowell, as far as what they're doing. But it's this is different than anything Beamer's done. And so, just looking at it year to year, and looking back at the history, you know, when South Carolina has attempted to do this, it's never not produced, you know, in the last 40 years. It's never failed to produce a better offense statistically. It's never not improved the play of the quarterback. You know, we can debate if Jake Bentley had I think Jake Bentley had a good year in 18. I think he had some bad games. But, you know, I don't think it's debatable that Steve Tannehill was better in 94 than 93, nor Phil Petty's better in 2000 than 99. You know, Garcia, obviously, and that, you know, adjusting the run game was better in 2010. And obviously, Spencer Rattler started lighting it up once they made the adjustment there. So that's good news for Lenore Sellers and good news for South Carolina's offense. Now, what it hasn't always led to is winning, right? Well, because you need defense and special teams, right? And you don't know the teams on your schedule are pretty good and things like that. In 85, Carolina went 5-6. In 86, they won three games, 3-6-2. Should have had those ties. See, special teams hurt them there. Otherwise, they would have matched the record. Now, 93-94, they went from 4 wins to 7 and won their first bowl game ever. 99-2000 was one of the best turnarounds in college football history from 0-11 to 8-4. 17-18, they didn't win as many. They only won, they went 7-6. That team had some issues on defense for sure compared to 17 when, gosh, Dante Sawyer alone forced 5 fumbles. That 17 defense had a lot of ability to take the ball off people, kind of like Clayton White's teams did. And they just didn't get them in 18. And they were hurt. And gosh, DJ Wonnum was in and out of the lineup that year. I still remember the Clemson game, which was wild. They were running in walk-ons and everything else on the D-line, and it was just, it was tough. Josh Belk played a bunch in that game because everybody was just hurt. It's crazy. You know, 2022, they obviously won those two games. You know, 2009 to 10 with a little tweak, we'll call that the little tweak, they went from a 7-6 team to winning the SEC East. So history, they've had some historical feats. First bowl game, best turnaround, SEC East with the tweak. That's the caveat there. I don't know, again, that that's a lot just exactly like this, but it was a departure from where they were struggling, which was in the run game. And they did have a new plan that probably the run game became more aggressive, creative, and fun. So we'll call that a half change under Steve Spurrier, but it paid off. Now, I'm not saying that if Marcus Lattimore had not signed with South Carolina, that it would have paid off because that guy was just, people ask me who the million-dollar guy would be that I would have paid in recent history. It would have been Marcus Lattimore because you have tangible proof of what he meant in his performance as far as the Gamecocks winning football games. Love Marcus Lattimore, but I'm a big Burns homer, so you guys know that. So we'll see what happens, but there's historical precedent here for things to get better offensively, at least. Doesn't always 100% lead to wins, but it has, and it has led to some history, if you especially if you include the half change. So that brings us to the offensive line in closing. And this is from Dog Stats on X, and saw that, and my man Chris Marler retweeted it and made some comments on it this morning, and I caught it. So just wanted to give him a shout out because it was right there sitting on my Twitter account. And so South Carolina went older in the portal. We talk about, everybody talks about being old. I guess that's the new trend because of Indiana. Older in the portal on the offensive line. And get this. So Dog Stats compiled who has the most returning career snaps in the country. And that's including guys anywhere, like in college football. And it's South Carolina, 8,797 career snaps. You wouldn't think it, considering they lost everybody, just about. But 8,797 career snaps. What does that mean? I don't know. Because you look at some of the other ones, and I don't know what the outlook is for these. Nebraska's second, 83-89. Pitt, 82-10 is third. Cal, 80-78 is fourth. Oklahoma State had a coaching change, 77-01. Indiana, 73-73. That offensive line for Indiana, between 2024 and 2025 got a lot better. And they have a stud at tackle, too. I mean, they've got good players. West Virginia, 70-78. Oklahoma is next in the SEC at 62-98. Miami, Ohio, 68-92. And the Texas Tech Red Raiders, 67-99. So in the SEC, And I'm not going to bore you with the exact number. South Carolina and Oklahoma are 1 and 2. Check this out. Tennessee third, Kentucky fourth, A&M fifth, LSU sixth, Arkansas seventh, Florida eighth, Texas nine, Georgia 10, Auburn 11, Missouri 12, Bama 13. Mississippi State 14, Ole Miss 15, Vandy 16. And last, as far as returning snaps, career snaps on the offensive line. So what does that mean? I don't know exactly. It's kind of like we said last offseason in one way. It's kind of like we said all last offseason, bigger is not always better, and it ended up not being better, it ended up being worse. South Carolina all this size. But coaches will tell you a lot that they want experience on the offensive line as a baseline positive. And so, like I said, I don't know how it's going to work out. I think it's key because the one way that is a very good way to stop the type of offense that South Carolina is installing and to make this a historical season coming up in 2026 in a bad way, because the Gamecocks go backward while upgrading their scheme, is to have a bad offensive line and just get dominated up front. That's just the way to stop it, because if you can't block them, it doesn't matter how fast you're getting it off, and then you're going three and out, your defense is getting drug all over the field. It can be a disaster. So it's very important. But I like a lot of the guys they've gotten. I'm going to talk more about some of maybe the under the radar players in the offensive line class later this week and on the show. But I like them. I think they've got some guys. Obviously, Jacarius Peake is and Carter Miller are two very, very nice pickups from the portal. But what they are at their foundation before a single snap has been taken in spring practice is experienced. And that's really what you want on the O-line. And if you're going to lose that many guys that have been with your program and you're going to replace them, and you replace them with the most experienced group collectively in the country, I'm not going to say, I guess that's in FBS. How about that? Yeah, I don't know. You get that experience, but that much of an experienced offensive line at the lower levels, probably somebody's going to jack a couple of them through the portal. But and you have the most experienced group collectively snap wise in the country. That's pretty dang good. That's not bad. That's a good starting point. So there you have it. A little hope on a Monday morning for an offensive turnaround. Because I could have gone through all that, and I'm so thankful that I saw that tweet this morning. Because I could have gone through all that and I'd been like, but the offensive line. So I wanted to give you a little something to hang your hat on. South Carolina Gamecocks have the most career snaps on the offensive line collectively in the country heading into 2026. Now, you look at the other teams up there, not all of them have superior outlooks. There's very few SEC teams even in the top 10. Oklahoma's the other one. And they weren't good on the offensive line last year, but they got some other guys in through the portal as well. But so if you're gonna kind of rebuild it, hats off to Darren Usher and Randy Clements and Sam Sirbay. Rebuild it with experience, man. Because of Indiana, we're going into the offseason of older is better, and then watch a team with a bunch of freshmen and sophomores win the national championship next season. Just how it goes in this sport. Anyway, thanks for coming to my chat. Appreciate all you guys listening to Coffee Guys and Gals. Don't forget the morning show coming up, the show. Also, the late night Gamecock show and SEC Sunday night will be up on podcast form. Please go visit those channels on Apple Podcast and rate them 5 stars. Subscribe. Four Quarter Friday. It was a great show on Friday with Matt and Steve talking about the region classifications and stuff. That's good stuff there too. Very interesting how they did the regions in South Carolina of high school basketball. Lots of good talk. Please check that out and like their YouTube channel. It's at Four Quarter Friday, youtube.com at Four Quarter Friday. Just go hit that subscribe button. And then also get them on podcast as well. Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music. It's everywhere. All right, folks, it's been Coffee with JC Sherbert. I'm out. See you on the show. Holla.